Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Naked Englishman podcast on the 15th of May 2025. It's a nice day. Well, it's a bit cloudy. It's not as hot as it has been this morning. Bit of cloud, bit of blue. So can't say whether it's ye olde chemtrails or not. And just strolling into the kitchen here to have a look at the time. It's just gone 8:10, and the cat wishes to come in. Hello, Puss. In you come, dear boy. Have you been fed? Not sure. Is your food down? You're giving me all the signs that you haven't been fed, so we will do that. It's coming. I'll give you a little treat to keep you off my legs. There you go. Have a scoff of that. And whilst you're scoffing that, I will just get your special cat food out. So, you all right? Bless you, my dear. Lovely Julia is wallowing in the bath at the moment as we speak. Yesterday I had a chap over from Ledbury, and well, he stayed last night in his van. Not last night, night before last. And he's trying to save a venue that he runs by various things. And he wanted to sort of clear his head and talk about it with somebody. And he said, I'd love to come over to where you live. Can I come over and do whatever? And I said, yes, yes, come over and have a chat. I said, I've got things to do. I've got interviews to do and various things. But in between all of that, I dare say. So we had a good old chinwag. On Wednesday night it was. I can't remember if we mentioned any of this in yesterday's Naked Englishman. The days are long and full of stuff. Mostly I did a bit more work on my book, which was good, and in the evening we cooked a lovely casserole, which was superb. I'd like to say a big thank you to Duncan and his mum, who sent this very lovely letter. And some money, not for me, but for Billy, my son, who's been suffering from seizures. And Billy was so touched. I saw him yesterday and told him. And I said, we're going to the farm shop today, which is what we are doing. And I said, there's some money to buy you some good quality food, particularly meat. He's on a ketogenic diet at the moment. And on the advice of Dr. Sarah Myhill, who is a friend of ours now. Which is lovely, and our go-to doctor, which is rather nice. So he, because he's having seizures, he's not allowed to drive at the moment, which obviously impedes his movements. So I said, well, we're going anyway on Thursday. We'll go and get you some extra grub, and trying to keep him going. So that's one of the plans. So I'm just pulling on some socks, which, if you sounds strange, I'm sort of making grunts and groans. And then putting on my... just come out of the bath, actually. Had a lovely warm bath. And it's... We got up this morning, actually. Got up about 5:30. Julia and I. And came down, had a cup of tea, coffee... and had a little chin chat about life, the universe and everything. Very nice, a little bit of meditation. It was very nice, smoked a pipe. There we go. So that was jolly, wasn't it? That was very lovely. So now I'm feeling a bit tired. And then we sort of just gone off to have a bath and soon to head off to the farm shop. I've got a video to do, which I should do very shortly. I've got an idea for that. So that's nice. The cat has been out, as you heard, and has come back in and has snubbed his food, but it ate his treats. But he will go and eat his food. I am certain of that. And the rest of the day is going to be devoted to writing the book. Tomorrow, I have a couple of interviews. And then Saturday, down to Exeter to do the Great Resist. Unfortunately, the lovely Julia can't make it. We are going to be away doing a Barbara O'Neill event very soon as well. So it's a busy month, and we're getting into that sort of busy time again of various events. I wish I had my book finished, because that would be nice financially to be able to sell a few copies of the book if people are interested. I mean, I've no idea how it's going to go, to be honest with you. I've been working on it. It's got these various truths in it, but who knows whether anybody's actually going to be interested in purchasing a copy. A few people have said they would, but of course when it comes to it, they may go, do you know what, I cannot be bothered. So that is an issue. It is hard work doing the thing, but the other day we sat, Julia and I sat in the sunshine and worked on it together, which was very nice and very useful. I think I spoke about that yesterday, I can't remember. So that was nice. Looks like there's a little bit of a breeze out there, but it does seem to be clouding over a bit. We could do with some rain. I think the farmers are saying we could do with some rain now. And of course, immediately you start to get a little bit nervous, don't you? You go, is that what the plan is? I mean, this is one of the problems that people can get extremely worried about every slight variation. And, you know, when you've gone through down the rabbit hole, you do get somewhat, what's the word I'm looking for, tarnished, I suppose. Coming out the other end, you're always suspicious, cynical of everything that's ever put to you. That can be a bit of an issue with it all. So I thought I would today, just for a bit of difference, I would go to a book on the shelf. Time to go to a book on the shelf and just read a little bit. Now, some people like this, some people don't like it. No idea why. It's not for everybody. So I think I read to you a little bit from a book by Thomas Burke, didn't I, about travel. Just a very brief bit. I have another one of his on the shelf. I've just spotted it, actually. He was writing, as I said before, in the 1940s. This is English Nightlife. Very old book. 10 shillings and sixpence it was. A Batsford book. And he was an author who wrote these things. I love these old books. If anybody's got any of these sort of old books and they don't want them, do let me know. I would willingly look at them and potentially purchase them. Just looking to see when this was published, whether it says... some of these old books did not put the dates in. Oh yes, it does here. This is a first edition, published 1941. Still with dust cover. Not in a great condition, I have to say. Full of dust. Dust on the dust cover. But anyway, let's find a chapter to start on. Somewhere in the middle. It's quite fun to just start in the middle somewhere. Or sometimes towards the end, because one always tends to go. Here we go. We won't go home till morning, it says. London nightlife in the first quarter of the 1800s was various, both in its diversions and in its quality of those diversions. There were the formal and elegant knights of Holland House and Almack's, the more formal but less elegant knights of Carlton House, the theatre and tavern and club knights, the opera knights, and those knights at certain smart and notorious houses, which many of the male nobility attended, and notorious houses. Did I just say that? Yes, and notorious houses, many of which, sorry, my eyes are not scanning very well, and of which we can get the idea from Harriet Wilson's account of the receptions given at the house of her sister Amy. Table customs in London continued to be those of the country. In the country, the first quarter of 1800s we're talking about. In the country, where there was nothing else to do, there was some excuse for the long-strung parade of dishes and the processions of wines. But in London and other cities, which offered variety of entertainment, surely nothing but gluttony would have kept men 8 hours at table. Angelo records a supper he attended in the Thatched House Tavern given by the Royal Duke of Sussex in 1806. The prince was the chief guest. They sat down at 9 o'clock. The solid part of the supper, the eating, went on till about 1 in the morning. The Duke, seeing the glasses, were refilled every 5 minutes. Angelo stuck to one wine, hock, and to this he attributed the fact that he was able to keep his head. At 1 o'clock the cloth was drawn and the decanters were set on the table, and the serious part of drinking began. Songs were called for. The prince obliged with a song, Tom Moore obliged, other guests obliged. When songs began to pall, the Duke introduced onto the table a dwarf who danced among the decanters and dessert. Fresh wines were introduced to whet the palate, and more songs were given. The company rose from the table at 5 o'clock. Formal dinners of that kind might consist of only a few courses, but each course had many dishes, and it was the custom to taste something of everything. One dinner of that time for a company of 15 may be taken as typical of many. And then it's got the menu. Turtle soup, turtle cutlets, white bait, sauté of haddock, turbot, fillets of whitings, John Dory. Boiled chicken, roast chicken, ham tongue, tendons of lamb, haunch of venison. Larded poults, roast goose, roast hare, roast quails, salad Italian, tart, jelly, cheesecakes, cabinet pudding, prawns. With that dinner went Madeira, Champagne, Hermitage, Burgundy, Bordeaux, 22 bottles, hock and port. Gronow's description of the dinner of that time was that they were solid, hot and stimulating. The dessert, if for a dozen people, would cost at least as many pounds. A perpetual thirst seemed to come over people, both men and women, as soon as they had tasted their soup, as from that moment everyone was taking wine with everybody else, till the close of the dinner, and such wine as produced that class of cordiality which frequently wanders into superfaction. How all this sort of eating and drinking ended was obvious. The social occasions of the middle and professional classes were conducted with a little more sense. The eccentric, at that time, famous Dr. Kitchener, author of The Art of Cookery, and a treatise on music, gave excellent and well-devised dinners to his friends. He would invite them to attend his house at such and such an hour to join a committee of taste and eta beta pie, whatever that might be. He also, once a week, held conversazioni, where all the lively and intelligent spirits of the time were seen. The entertainment was talk, music and song, or perhaps a visit to his roof observatory, where he had a telescope and studied astronomy. But for both dinners and conversazioni, he had one strict rule, which was printed and fixed above the mantel shelf. Come at 7, go at 11. Since few parties get warmed up before the third hour, it meant that his guests often had to break up mid-air of their interests and merriment. Their reluctance at observing this rule was at once hinted by the younger George Coleman. He made a slight alteration to the notice, adding a word so that it read, "Come at 7, go at it at 11." The good doctor ignored the hint, and closing time remained as it was. How fascinating. So there we go, a little insight there to the rich and famous, I suppose. Probably for the poor peasants of lower income, they had different types of revelry. But a fascinating book with a fascinating history studied by Thomas Burke, B-U-R-K-E. And it's a lovely book, and it's on my shelf. And I'm very thrilled to have it. I have, funnily enough, that is that's English Night by Thomas Burke. And then there's a more up-to-date version of this. Hang on, let me just struggle over to the shelf and return this book from whence it came. And these are the sort of books that I would treasure, I do treasure, for if I was writing of that period, you know, these sort of books you would read and then you would write your novel with some of that information sort of dotted in it. The other book I've got is by Lawrence James, big tome of a book, this one, published, I'm going to guess this was published either in the 80s or the 90s. I'm just bringing it down now. And it's called A Middle Class, A History. And so it talks about that. It was £8.50 when I bought it, hardback. Published, oh, I beg your pardon, first published in 2006. So I was well out. Again, just briefly. I don't want to hold you up with all my reading and stuff. This is from chapter 4, and it's called Those Eminent Blood, the Gentry. If one was to devise a game upon snakes and ladders, in which players strove to advance themselves in late medieval and early modern England, the winners would be those who made it up to the gentry, or, and this was a long shot, the aristocracy. Upward movement would depend upon inherited capital, generous kinsfolk, and friends. A wife, with an ample dowry, a capacity to make the most of opportunities for enrichment, natural intelligence, and education. Sickness, accidents, infertility, lawsuits, and the caprices of the market would propel people, players, downwards. The cast of a die would represent the incalculable elements of good luck, which contemporaries would have called providence. And personal temperament. Fundamental to the rules of the game was the universal acceptance of the fact that society was open. It was possible, if not always easy, to climb one or even more than one rung in the ladder. There were hurdles. Myths had been invented which invested the degrees of gentlemen, esquires, knights, and noblemen with a peculiar mystique. Their bloodline stretched back to the creation when Adam's second son, Seth, had been blessed by his father and God. Seth was the progenitor of all those who were gentle. His brother, the murderer Cain, cursed by God and his father, was the ancestor of all churls, in whose blood ran his inclination towards wickedness. This division of humanity into gentle and ungentle was explained by Juliana de Burgess, de Berners, a knight daughter and prioress, in her book of Albans, St. Albans, which was written at the end of the 14th century. It was printed in 1486, and probably because it contained a mass of useful and recondite information on hunting and angling, went through 6 editions in the next 100 years. Dame Juliana's digressions on the scriptural origins of gentry and the source of their inherited virtue were repeated with elaborations by Gerald Lee in his A Cadence of Armoury, 1562, a popular handbook on heraldry. The author was a herald, an occupation that entitled him to call himself a gentleman, although he had once worked as a draper in London alongside his father, who was an illegitimate son of one of the Lees, a knightly Cheshire family. Nonetheless, Lee felt obliged to promote the notion that the gentle owed their elevated position and moral qualities to their common ancestor, Seth. Jesus, he added, was a gentleman because of his genealogy, as given in St. Matthew's Gospel, and traced his ancestry back to King David. So there you go, a little insert there of fascinating, really. I have not read all of it. I have read about a third of it, I think. And I think some of these books, I mean, you can read them, as some people do, just from cover to cover, but I find the reason I buy these books are for research purposes more than anything else, I suppose. And I was fascinated by that particular period of the labourer and the farmer, and then the middle classes and the rich. And it is a fascinating, you know, social history. It's very interesting what people do, because you can see what people did in the past and what they're doing now, what they're not doing now, and reflect on those things, I think, from a, I guess, an intellectual point of view. But as an observer of the world, which I suppose in some respects I might be, we all observe, don't we? We all observe part of the world. Anyway, there we go. That's today's little piece of the puzzle in the old Vobes world. And I hope it has been edifying. There's a word for you. Until the next one, toodle-pip, take care and enjoy yourselves.